Thank you very much. And this is really exciting. I thank you all for being here at the beginning of what I understand is a very busy term for all of you. So this is a thrill for me. I think like many American academics, I have this very romantic idea of what it means to come to Oxford. So I've really been looking forward to this and appreciate it. And now that I've buttered you up, I'm gonna make my caveat, which is that what I'm presenting today is very much a work in progress. This seemed like a wonderful opportunity for me, very selfishly, to put out some material that is new, and that I'm still very much working through. So I hope you'll forgive the fact that this is going to be a little bit informal. What I've been doing is sort of laboring in under the harsh circumstances of sabbatical in southern France for the year, trying to write this book, which is as awful as it sounds. But it has meant that I haven't had a lot of opportunity to sort of trot this material out, and so this is a good opportunity for me. So what I'm going to be presenting here is the beginnings, the kind of introduction and parts of the first chapter, or parts of those two, of a book on the ex-combatants living in Monrovia today. And what I'm really interested in this project, and I'll talk a little bit more about the project as a whole in a second, but trying to think about what it means for young men who are involved in the war in Liberia to try to come to terms with the city, the post-war city, and try to imagine their futures within it. So I'll talk a bit more about the project as a whole in just a second, but I want to begin with a story. I hope you don't mind. I'm going to sort of move back and forth between reading parts of this and then sort of ad-libbing through it. But I want to begin with this 2012 photograph of the interior of the Ministry of Defense building in the Liberian capital of Monrovia. And as you'll see, photographs are sort of an important part of a lot of my research in general and an important part of what I'm presenting today. This hulking structure was originally part of a building campaign that was launched by Samuel Doe, a junior military officer who took over the Liberian presidency following a 1980 coup d'etat. Monumental architecture for Doe, as for so many political leaders, was a project of state-making and personal aggrandizement. The ministry building was to be one of the largest structures in West Africa and one of several government projects that would enshrine Doe and his cohort on the Monrovia landscape. The Ministry of Defense was never finished. The war broke out in Liberia at the end of 1989. The Israeli firm that was contracted to design and construct the building completed its concrete support, but little more. Even before the fighting reached Monrovia, the ministry building was a skeleton, though it was a structurally sound one. Now, until mid-2010, there were hundreds of former fighters of the government of Liberia armed forces that were squatting in the Ministry of Defense. These were primarily Taylor's people. Many of them had been living there for a decade, and they'd created within the space a vibrant, though crowded, community. Major Sandy, and this is Major Sandy here, has now lived in the ministry for more than 10 years. For the first eight of those years, he was simply one among hundreds of other squatters. Soldiers, militia fighters, and their dependents were barracked in the structure to defend the man who had ultimately succeeded Doe, Liberia's warlord president, Charles Taylor. When Taylor was ousted in 2003, the men who fought to defend him remained in the building and maintained the roughly built vertical community that they had created within the structure's ruined form. When the government of Taylor's successor, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, ordered the building's occupants to leave in 2010, most of the young men who had occupied the space had few options. Monrovia's existing slum settlements are grossly overcrowded. Many now live on the beach, in garbage dumps, in graveyards, in swamps, or in other unfinished buildings around Monrovia. Major Sandy was allowed to stay in the Ministry of Defense as a caretaker and a night watchman. A Chinese telecom company has placed towers on the roof of the ministry, and it keeps a handful of security people on the property. But Major Sandy lives alone in a closet, surrounded by thousands of vacant square feet of reinforced concrete. Now, recently the Johnson Sirleaf government has begun a survey of this building. Its original blueprints were destroyed, and no one at the ministry or in the government seems to know how large the building is, how it's configured, or how it was constructed. And when I ask Major Sandy what he hopes will be done with the building once this survey is complete, he pauses. This apparently is not a question to which he has given much thought. After a minute, he said, "It should be given back to the Ministry of Defense, or maybe a hotel. I think it would make a nice hotel." Now, the question that I put to Major Sandy, what futures can be imagined in the ruins of a space like the Ministry of Defense, and his surreal answer suggests a larger and more complex set of questions. How do the young men who fought this region's war understand the urban environment and their place within it? What do the built forms of the city evoke for them as possible futures, futures for themselves and future for the city writ large? The architectural spaces in which so many of them have been barracked during and after the war are the product of a modernist conception of urban dwelling that began long before the Liberian War. But through a history of modern warfare, of urban warfare, aging, voluntary and involuntary neglect, that patrimony has largely fallen into ruin. In this West African city, are those modernist ruins actually habitable today? Now, that's the larger question that really, for me, has sort of framed the book that I'm working at. And for those of you who either know your Nietzsche or your architectural history, you may recognize the quote from the title of this talk. This was a quote from Nietzsche's The Gay Science that apparently Le Corbusier had, the architect, had found incredibly important and meaningful in his development of modern architecture. And for both of them, this phrase, live dangerously, brothers, was really a call to think differently about how one inhabits space, how one inhabits built forms, and ultimately how one inhabits the city. And for me, it's a quote that frames this little book project quite nicely, because what I'm really trying to do is try to understand the lives of ex-combatants in a city that is very difficult for them, in which they are constantly striving to invent new ways to survive. And in particular, coming to grips with the material ruins of Monrovia. So in a sense, the book is a look at how modern African cities have become especially part of a certain kind of political imaginary for young men who were involved in this conflict. A bit of background, I've spent a number of years researching militia movements in Sierra Leone and Liberia and the combatants that were involved with them, and trying to make the argument that for most of the fighters on both sides of that, both sides of the border in this region, that participation in this violent period was essentially a form of labor. And what that gave rise to was the idea that what we were witnessing across West Africa was the formation of what I, in some of this earlier work, had called barracks spaces. That the most important development for understanding the lives and the trajectories of young men that were involved in the fighting was to think of them as occupying these barrack spaces. And what that meant was that they were subject to processes of rapid assembly where they were brought together, held in this kind of state of waiting, and then deployed around the region as necessary. And violence became the nexus through which one could understand the logics of these deployments. And that essentially, the history of the war was a history of a new form of labor for them. And that trying to think about this model of the conceptual model of the barracks was a useful way in which to understand their movements across this region. Now, I still think this is true, and it's an important part of what's happening even today. But one of the things that I felt was missing from that story was really an understanding of what the spaces themselves were like. That this, it's one thing to make the argument that there are these proliferation of barrack-style spaces happening all over this region, and it's another to really delve into what those look like and how they operate. And so that's a bit about what this current project is looking at, because what we're finding in post-war Monrovia, at least, is that for years afterwards, you've had ex-combatants squatting in the ruins of these massive structures and other sort of interstitial spaces around Monrovia. And so my argument, my experience has been working with them that they're still subject to the same logics of assembly and deployment, and in a sense have become even more highly mobile. And so this current project is really trying to understand the built material aspects of the spaces they inhabit and the politics of space for them. Now, the backdrop to this, and it's an important thing to keep in mind, is that I'm sort of trying to work through this material in the context of an emergent literature on African cities that I'm sure many people in this room are familiar with. There's been a proliferation of what I think is very fascinating work on what African cities are, what African urbanism might be. Writers like Abdoulaye Simone, Philippe Dubuc, Simon and Jami, Edgar Peters, have been producing work that I find very influential and important, and it's some of the literature that I'm hoping to be in dialogue with this project. The other part is a little trickier, which is that the movements of young men in Monrovia that I'm looking at are also taking place against a global landscape of things like the Occupy movements, or what's been known as the Arab Spring. Efforts, especially on the part of young people around the globe, to try to lay claims to urban space in a different way. And so my own interest in sort of Liberia's ex-combatant population and their relationship to Monrovia is taking place against the backdrop of what seem to be emergent new forms of making claims on the city. And the question that really prompted this this particular book project for me is why the ex-combatants who had occupied spaces like the Ministry of Defense didn't make a similar kind of claim on that space when the government told them it was time to go. That they were being pushed out into the city, and yet they didn't, in the midst of all of this global movement to try to claim urban spaces in new ways, and in the midst of a certain kind of African studies literature that suggests certain trajectories for the African city, why is it that the young men who were fighters in Liberia's civil war didn't, or the Liberian war, didn't seem to be laying claim to spaces they inhabited for quite some time? Why is it that somebody like Major Sandy could imagine this building as a hotel, but not as a place to which young men had any right to remain? There's a lot of talk in Liberia in this period about going back to war, but none of it is really aimed at resisting those kinds of forced movements, resisting their claims to space. So in a way, this is a book that's becoming an ethnography of a kind of unmaterialized or failed political imaginary. Just to give you a little bit of a sort of the context for the project, so I'm looking at four buildings in the Monrovia landscape and sort of doing it in a sense an analysis of the buildings as a way to think about the trajectories of the people who lived there. But what I'm going to be presenting now for the rest of the time is more of a general kind of ethnography of the way that these young men were inhabiting the city, the way they occupied Monrovia. So a brief background, and I'll keep this short because I think that most people are at least passingly familiar with this the history here. Monrovia was the epicenter of a conflict that spanned essentially from 1989 until 2003. Within that period, there were really three major rounds of fighting in the capital itself, 1990, 1992, and then 2003. And it's that last period that's really crucial for what I'm going to be talking about, because at that moment, this was the siege of Monrovia. You had thousands of young men from around the region descending on the city in an incredibly violent period that ended up with the ouster of Charles Taylor. Many of those young men have stayed in the capital. They've remained in Monrovia for a number of reasons, not least of which is that Monrovia had always had the reputation of being the most developed city and with the most opportunities of any of the urban spaces in the region, despite the fact that it is incredibly overcrowded and had suffered a great deal of infrastructure damage. There is an enormous amount of wealth in the city, and so a lot of the ex-combatants have stayed there. Also in part because, at least until for the early 2000s, the largest UN deployment anywhere was in Liberia. And so there was a perception, at least, that there was a great deal to be gained by for ex-combatants to remain in the city. Now, given this history, neither the long-term presence of squatters in Monrovia's iconic urban structures like the Ministry of Defense, nor their eviction is unusual in post-war Monrovia. The Ducor Hotel, one of the city's most prominent urban landmarks, was occupied for much of the war and for the decade afterward. The Ministries of Health and Agriculture, at least three of the largest downtown banks, the National Stadium, political party headquarters, factories, beachside and suburban villas, and a major metropolitan hospital were all claimed as housing during the country's tumultuous decades of conflict. The Ellen Johnson Sirleaf government, which came to power in 2006, has brought with it a measure of stability. With that stability, Liberians who fled the war are returning or remitting capital. Global financial institutions like the World Bank, the IMF, are bankrolling development projects, as are a dizzying array of NGOs and UN agencies. Multinational corporations trading in West Africa's natural resources and the financial industries that support that trade are all returning to a country that generates tremendous wealth for those who can manage the risk. Reclaiming and rehabilitating urban space is a major component of this post-war activity. And so you have this very strange situation where, in some ways, the politics of Monrovia right now have stabilized in a way that they haven't been for quite some time. And yet, At the same time, the city itself, as a material space, seems to become ever more unstable. You still have this problem of mass overcrowding, and you have a population that is highly, highly mobile, and even the physical infrastructure of the city seems to be constantly morphing. Now, while the need for urban infrastructure improvement may be obvious, the mechanics by which it is achieved are not. In a few instances, former ministry buildings have been rehabilitated, often with World Bank or Chinese government funding, and the ministries have moved back into them. More often, squatters are evicted from spaces that then remain vacant for extended periods. On other buildings, work proceeds in fits and starts, and seems rarely to be completed before the effort is abandoned. And often the plans for these buildings are a mystery. Rumors circulate around Monrovia that empty structures will be given to American companies, or that the Chinese will come and develop them, or that they'll be turned back over to the government, which usually means they'll go to one of a number of important families. In short, thousands of Liberians, including a sizable population of ex-combatants, are being evicted without clear purpose from spaces in Monrovia that they have successfully made their homes for many years. The upshot is that Monrovia, like many African cities, appears more liquid than solid. And this metaphor of a kind of liquid city is one, again, we're starting to see become more and more common in African studies. Simon Njami's has written actually quite exquisitely about the idea of cities that have no geometry. Philippe de Buc has now famously talked about invisible cities, or cities that exist beyond their architecture. And Abdoumalik Simone's phrase, people as infrastructure, all seem to be getting at this idea of a kind of dematerialization of African urban spaces. I put these up for those who are interested in photography, Ananias Lake-Hidalgo's images of Abidjan, right, which are all about the idea of a different sort of geometry of the city, if you will. What these literatures amount to, in one way or another, is a concept of African urbanism that is a synthesis of movement, invisibility, and experimentation. The productiveness of the city for many of its inhabitants is found in the creative ways that people work this intersection. The materiality of the city is therefore treated as a backdrop to the city's more significant, immaterial social processes, where it functions as raw material, open to endless and infinite reworkings. There's a genericness and an ephemerality to African cities that seem to make such reworkings possible, to produce a city that, in De Beck's words, exists beyond its architecture. Now, I find these framings absolutely appropriate for understanding Monrovia's post-war form of urbanism. Most of the ex-fighters with whom I've worked have found no fixed place in what we might call the formal or the legible city. Few have been incorporated into the post-Taylor state security apparatus. The disarmament campaign was essentially a disaster. Most of these young men have no stable housing, and they have very little guarantees on any of the spaces they do occupy. And they have a very ambiguous standing vis-a-vis the police and the social juridical order of the city. Basically, these are young men who are forced to be constantly on the move, and they're constantly experimenting with ways to survive in the city. And yet, I don't think it's enough to simply identify the immaterial aspects of the African urban space. Once we've labeled African urbanism as liquid, then what? The question that I think still remains is, how does this dematerialization actually take place? How does a city liquefy in the minds of those who live there? Clearly in Monrovia, and I would argue in every African city today, space still matters. So what is the politics of space for Liberia's ex-combatant population? And given the desperate conditions under which they're living today, why do they seem to surrender so completely to the logic of immateriality? And why do they fail to resist its consequences? So let me get a little bit more into some of the ethnographic nuts and bolts here. 2012, I spent some time talking to ex-combatants who were squatters in the Ministry of Defense that I had showed you earlier, and were currently living in a section of Monrovia that they had nicknamed Zimbabwe. And they called it Zimbabwe basically because they were very much aware of Robert Mugabe's efforts in Zimbabwe to reclaim land, of the housing demolitions, et cetera. And so they had sort of ironically and with the usual sort of sense of humor, dark humor that goes with this, sort of co-opted the name Zimbabwe for the space they occupied. And I wanted to get a sense of how they operated within this area that they had claimed. And what I came up with was a series of narratives about how important movement was to ex-combatants' life in the city. And that's sort of what I want to talk about for a second. So very briefly, I'll read a bit of this and to sort of set the stage here. There are only two fixed landmarks in the eastern Monrovia sector known as Zimbabwe, the taxi rank on UN Drive and the Truck Inn bar which sits behind it. A patchwork of houses, individual rooms, bamboo shelters, alleys, and footpaths extend out from these spaces, but it's a constantly shifting landscape. What space makes up Zimbabwe depends on who inhabits them at any given moment, and Zimbabwe itself only exists for a small population of ex-combatants, their families, and friends. Kofi is the senior man at Zimbabwe. Kofi fought first with Samuel Doe, then with Ulimo, and finally with Lurd. So if you know your Liberian history, those names will mean something to you. Most of the young men who live in Zimbabwe were part of his unit during the war in one or more of these factions, and they all now at least need his tacit permission to be in Zimbabwe or to what they call go on operations from there. So even they still use this military terminology of going on operations. So if you're hustling in the city, you're using the language of warfare. Kofi estimates that there are about 60 boys, in his terms, who sleep in Zimbabwe on any given night, though for most of them, Zimbabwe is kind of one of many spaces in the city that they occupy for quite a long time, for some cases for hours, days, or longer. And the way that many of these young men make a living, such as they do in Zimbabwe, is working the taxi rank. And what that means is that at any moment you could be helping people load bags into upcountry taxis. You could be portering for goods around the city. You could be set up a small money changing stall. You could be serving on the watch committee, which I'll talk about just a bit more, which is sort of the subcontracted police force. Or what most of them are actually making money on, you could be stealing cell phones. As passengers are getting into the car, you grab the phone. And it's actually a fascinating economy to watch because many Monrovians know how this works. Your phone is stolen, and then the money changer, who happens to be the witness to this, comes up and says, "Gee, this is an awful shame. I'm really sorry, but it turns out I kind of know that guy, and I could probably get your phone back for a small fee." And then most cases, what you do is you end up buying back the SIM card, and then later in the day, there's another neighborhood in Monrovia called Buy Your Own Things, where you go and you go back and buy the actual phone a bit later. So it's a very the fascinating thing is at any moment, the same young men could play any one of those roles. They could be the local security force, they could be the cell phone thief, or they could be the money changer who just happened to be sitting there. Being that the place is a ghetto, explains Roland, one of the young men who lives in Zimbabwe, and the police come from far away and don't know the area, they're not really active here. So the police have outsourced security to the watch committee, who, like the money changers, are primarily ex-combatants. On any given day, Zimbabwe's ex-combatant populace might play any one of these roles: money changer, baggage handler, watch committee member, thief. It's a thinly veiled facade, the shifting landscape of players and roles. Only one part of the performance is non-negotiable. The aggrieved party cannot him or herself enter Zimbabwe in pursuit of the thief. For them, it is a no-go area. For them, Zimbabwe doesn't exist. Now, in some ways, this is the perfect dramatization of a kind of African urbanism that, as Madou Malik Simone has put it, fractures the logical correlations between cause and effect. The flows of wealth, people, and information are too chaotic and too unpredictable to chart linear paths through space or time. City life in many quarters of contemporary African cities has therefore become a métier of experimentation, in which storytelling, bluffing, and the scam are, at least for many young men, the quintessential urban practices. Young people in particular must invent their own outcomes and the performances through which they hope to realize them. And just another quick narrative, right next to Zimbabwe is a garbage dump, and I was struck because there was a young man who would spend his days walking around the perimeter of the dump wearing a uniform that he had apparently stolen from a private security company. And apparently at one point he had been a member of one of Charles Taylor's militias but had no official role at this point, but he had sort of walked into this dump and had declared himself the police force for this neighborhood. And obviously, everybody sort of laughed at this, and yet the longer he was there, the more often people would come to him to settle disputes. And because it turned out he was actually reasonably good at this. And periodically, he would just go and arrest somebody, and then you would have to pay him to get your to get the person back. And you know, you would say, well, why are people allowing him to do this? And, well, he's cheaper than the real police force, right? So he had actually kind of invented this space of possibility for himself. Now, his obviously is an extreme example, but it's an extremity of degrees and not quality. As anthropologists working in other African cities have shown, these practices of invention are often practices of the body. Young men in Kinshasa and Lusaka use designer clothing to mark themselves as cosmopolitan worldly, even if doing so leaves them virtually penniless. In his ethnography of Abidjan's Blafeur, Sasha Newell describes how how male youth put any surplus resources toward luxury goods and bar tabs, creating an obviously performed image of themselves as wealthy men capable of consuming without care. And again, sort of to go back to my fixation with African photography, you see images like this, which I think, again, probably many people are familiar with. Philip Kwame Apaga's portraits from Ghana of young people having themselves photographed against backdrops like the New York City skyline or luxury domestic appliances, and visualizing themselves in places they've never been or with goods they don't own. Fantastic and phantasmatic as they seem, these mimetic practices can, and often do, bring about new realities for those who perform them. So what Zimbabwe suggests is that in Monrovia, at least, these practices of invention are also practices of space. For Monrovia's ex-combatant population, the opportunities to participate in even meager displays of conspicuous consumption were limited in the post-war city. What they cannot accomplish through the circulation of commodities, young men attempted through speed and the movement of their own bodies. Ex-combatants in Monrovia tended to disperse themselves around the city, and they circulated between urban spaces to seize or generate emergent opportunities. So in other words, my experience was a lot of these ex-fighters were sort of lodging themselves in multiple places around the city, multiple dwellings, cycling between them as quickly as they could, and within that continuous circuit of movement, looking for new ways to invent new possibilities for themselves. Imagining, in some cases, what might seem to be completely outlandish or impossible scenarios, and yet, as we learn in other African cities, to some extent, being able to conjure forth new realities out of just the sheer inventiveness and the mobility that they were exhibiting as they created these moved through these new spaces. Now, this extended even in Monrovia, at least, out into the peri-urban peripheries. For those of you who know the city, Monrovia is surrounded by rubber plantations and a network of old mining sites, usually gold, to a limited extent diamonds. And they're close enough to the city that one can fairly easily make the move between them. And so illegal encampments in the forest or the rubber plantations were becoming a very important part of how these young men were conceptualizing themselves within the city. And so they would move into the... for example, the Guthrie Rubber Plantation, camp in the forest for a few days, do some labor there, spend a few nights sleeping in the bush, and then move back into the city. And it became a kind of expansive, what I would still consider to be urban network, but one that reached out into the countryside as well. Now, the extent to which movement is integral to the political economy of spaces like Zimbabwe and these peri-urban mining zones is exemplified by a strange kind of nostalgia for the war years. For at least some combatants, peace is primarily a state of being that has limited their ability to move. The threat of returning to war is one that haunts many conversations in Monrovia today. Very few young men claim they want to go back to war, but an alarming number claim that if it came back to the region, they would unhesitatingly join, and it didn't matter to them which side they were going to be joining up with. This was sort of the rhetoric. We can talk a little bit more about this later if people are interested, but it's, to my mind, a very disturbing part of this story. Their language of war, though, tends to be spatialized. Returning to war is often depicted as an act of relocating from where one is at the present. My brother, this is a quote from one of the young men I was interviewing, "My brother, I will not lie," said one former commander, as I spoke with him in an illegal rubber tapping camp on the outskirts of Monrovia. "If I give the word, 1,000 men will leave this forest." And Skari, a man whose wartime circuit included time in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, had a very succinct and I think quite telling way of framing this. He talked about this almost a perverse kind of cosmopolitanism that happened during the war. And he said, you know, the Liberian people are backward, and the good thing that came out of the war is that we were forced to move and forced to learn new things, forced to think in different ways. War created opportunities for combatants and non-combatants alike because it propelled people in new spaces where they were forced to invent for themselves new possibilities. War, as he summarized his argument, is useful for movement, and that was kind of his framework. Now, it's important to recognize, however, that these fighters' nomadism is limited to certain kinds of spaces. The city for them was an agglomeration of spaces of invention, liquid spaces, the boundaries and cosmopolitanism of which were themselves constantly, in, or the boundaries and compositions of which were themselves constantly in motion. But the city was not smooth space, to use a Deleuzian term, for landscapes that foster experimentation and the undoing of dominant codes and regimes. The city was not a tabula rasa. Not every space was a space of invention for ex-combatants, piecing together circuits of navigation and movement. Ex-combatants' map of the city tended to be to consist of particular kinds of spaces: ruins, dumps, beachfronts, and car parks. For all of the apparent freewheelingness and liquidity of the urban milieu in which they maneuvered, most often young men found themselves in urban spaces of a very particular form, a form that imposed real limits on what their vision of city life could be. Now, I want to move into a second section of the talk, and I'm going to, now I'm really getting into it, so I'm going to take my coat off. That's permittable here, isn't it? Okay. This section is called Life in the Gap, and what I want to do here is, with this next few minutes, is to really explore how this kind of movement that I'm talking about fits a bit more into urban studies literature and into the kind of politics of that literature at the moment. Again, I'll sort of start with by setting an ethnographic scenario. This is an image of the Duport Road Cemetery. It's a small cemetery, not in the center of the city, but reasonably close to it. In 2012, there were about 100 young men who were living in the cemetery. Again, most of them were young men who had been evicted from the Ministry of Defense building. And they made their living, again, sort of very inventively. I mean, on the one hand, selling marijuana, which was not an uncommon thing, but they would dig graves periodically when there were burials. Families that had relatives interred there would pay them to, quote unquote, guard the graves, which very often meant not dig them up. So there was a little bit of money that way. There were sex workers who would work the graveyard. For the most part, the young men that I was involved with would would find ways to make money off of that trade as well. But essentially, they were occupying the spaces between the grave sites. The Duport Road Cemetery is a gap in the street parlance of Monrovia's ex-combatant populace. Congotown Back Road, another area that I write a little bit about, Zimbabwe, and the Ministry of Defense, and any a number of the city's beaches and trash dumps are all gaps in the city. It is in these spaces that ex-combatants accumulate, and from which they are recruited, and from which they operate, and between which they move. So they actually, that's the term that they use. Now, at some level, the Duport Road Cemetery and ex-combatants' other gaps are recognizable in the literature on interstitial spaces of the city and the possibilities that those spaces represent today. Most famous of these formations, and perhaps the most widely employed, is Michel Foucault's Heterotopias, the conceptualization of urban space that Foucault himself conveniently left very, very vague. And it's well beyond what I could do or really would even want to get too far into the Heterotopias literature. But in a nutshell, for those who don't know it, this was a way for Foucault to start to think about how new social and political forms could be invented, right? Where that could form, especially forms that were sort of unpermitted by the dominant codes. And particularly, it was a way to think about the formation of within certain spaces, and that although he gave a number of examples, the most powerful tend to be spaces in the urban environment where normal activities would prohibit certain kinds of experimentation, but there were interstitial spaces in the city where one could invent new forms of living, new forms of politics. This is an idea that has been incredibly important for a lot of different disciplines, and it still dominates a lot of urban theory today. I'm sort of intrigued by the way it impacted Partha Chatterjee's writing in The Politics of the Governed, which is a book that has a lot of resonance with some of the work that I'm doing here. And Chatterjee himself notes the importance of Foucault's Heterotopias to his thinking. And for Chatterjee, for those who are not familiar with this argument, most of the world's population engages in politics not by formal participation in civil society, but through creative negotiation with state and non-state entities. And to become what he calls political society, a population group requires a physical space in which to be located and through which to define itself. Now, interestingly, and this is where it becomes important for me, most of Chatterjee's examples are reminiscent of the gap spaces of Monrovia. They're squatters of the people involved in this formation of a political society are squatters of various neighborhoods and various interstitial spaces in Calcutta, in his example. One of the few things that these otherwise heterogeneous populations have in common and around which they build their political claims is a shared sense of belonging to urban space. Because they belong to a certain kind of space, they develop an identity and a solidarity through which they can negotiate and from which they can threaten violence, violent action if necessary. And violence is always that final straw, right? If we don't get what we want, there is the possibility that we, around, the people who have crafted this identity around this space, will take action, will take violent action to make it happen. And it's important to note that this has been a widespread theme, and it's interesting that it's especially become really salient among progressive architects and urban planners. There have been a lot of calls lately to try to figure out what a transgressive architecture might be. How do you create or foster spaces that function like Foucault's heterotopias or that become spaces of new political possibilities? How do you invent heterotopias? And a lot of the calls to invent an alternative politics are really about trying to harness that kind of energy and that kind of urban space. Torre David in Caracas may be one of the more famous examples. This is an unfinished skyscraper in the center of Caracas that squatters moved into and essentially set up a mini city within this space and have militantly fought to remain within that space and invented some really quite ingenious ways to run the space, to think of themselves as members of a community, and from there to invent new ways to inhabit the city. This is a book by a group known as Urban Think Tank, a kind of very progressive group of academics and architects who have been trying to say, well, this is the future of urbanism, right? Is trying to work in these interstitial spaces and understand them. Now, at the center of much of this thinking is the presumption that the relative invisibility of certain spaces in the modern city affords a kind of protection. Those who dwell in these spaces have a certain freedom to invent, because while they're in constant dialogue with the city writ large, they can tinker with its codes and conventions. They can explore new ways to make demands on other spaces in the city. Then, having fashioned new tools and developed new tactics, they can write new rules of engagement with those in power, at least up to a point. A certain invisibility in the modern city creates new spaces of new possibilities. The dematerialized spaces of the city are the new political spaces. So this is the point where all of these literatures come together, the heterotopias work and the African studies literature, which I think in essence is a lot of this emergent literature in African studies on African urbanism is an effort to think of them as heterotopias, heterotopic spaces, to try to identify what are the new spaces of inventiveness and what is the new politics that can take place in these interstitial sites that somebody like Chatterjee is finding elsewhere. Work on invisible cities, on people as infrastructure, I think at root are an effort to find this kind of alternative form of politics that African cities make possible. Now, this is attempting, for obvious reason, it's a tempting analytic framework through which to try to understand something like the Duport Road Cemetery, or indeed many of the spaces occupied by ex-combatants in Monrovia. There does seem to be something radically transgressive in the inventive practices of Duport Road Cemetery's youth, or the role-playing thefts in Zimbabwe. There does seem to be something agonistic and radically democratic, and that's a phrase from Gilles Durand, who's an urban theorist, in the way that ex-combatants sever and play with the logic of the city's social and political codes. In their threat of violence as the cost of ignoring their collective demands, in their practices of sharing and communalism, in the way they make urban detritus productive. Ex-combatants have enough of a sense of themselves as a category of populace, youth, rebel, ex-combatant, to have all of the, in Chatterjee's terms, moral attributes of a community, which is one of the crucial components for turning a population group into a political society. There is an identity among ex-combatants around the fact that they are ex-combatants, that they occupy certain kinds of spaces. And one would think, based on what we know, that would be the foundation of a new kind of politics. But reading the Duport Road Cemetery or Zimbabwe or any of other spaces inhabited by Monrovia's ex-combatants as heterotopic, as a transgressive architecture, or even as sites for enacting a politics of the governed would be a misreading. It would presume a relationship to these post-war city spaces and a political imaginary that simply is not there. It would be to mistake hypermobility for invisibility, and it would be to misconstrue the threat of violence for a political project. In other words, there really is, as far as I can see, there is no politics of the governed at work in Monrovia right now. Bless you. The heterotopia's idea really doesn't hold. The fact is that spaces like the Duport Road Cemetery do not undo the dominant codes of the city. They are its perfection. They take those codes to their logical extreme. The youth who inhabited Monrovia's gap spaces were frequently making claims on property and on material spaces of the city. The activities Chatterjee says are the important terrain of politics today. But there is in their claims and practices no discernible redefinition of property in the law, again Chatterjee's words, that could reasonably lead them to be called political society, or that could mark the spaces they inhabit as the grounds from which a political society could form. There's no question that the Duport Road Cemetery is productive space, as is Zimbabwe, the Ministry of Defense, and all of the other spaces in the city that these ex-combatants have claimed. They're spaces of invention, they're spaces of experimentation, and to some extent, they're spaces of play. But these forms of invention are circumscribed, for the most part, by a very limited political imagination and a very narrow set of material possibilities. They do not undo the dominant codes of the city or the political economy that governs it. They perfect them. And they keep in a constant state of readiness and waiting the bodies and labor of young men. Duport Road is not a platform for political city making. It is only a space for urban subjection. So I want to turn now to the last section here. And what I want to do with this is to try to explore a little bit more deeply what it is that ex-combatants actually imagine themselves to be doing in these gap spaces that they occupy. If the argument is in part that there's a very limited political imaginary at work here, how does that play out on the ground? I asked one of the men at Duport Road Cemetery how the ex-combatants who squatted there could stand to live amongst the dead, imagining that powerful occult forces that were parts of their lives in other ways must also be extremely palpable in a cemetery if that's where they were forced to live. The dead, he responded matter-of-factly, don't live there anymore. Now it's only a space for the living. In Monrovia, he added, once you die, you're finished. Asking the question of whose space belongs to, though, helps to illuminate the seeming aporia between urban spaces that host seemingly unlimited possibilities for invention and experimentation and a stunted political imaginary that is simultaneously produced within that space. And nowhere is this contradiction more evident than in the swamplands of Monrovia's Congo town and the sprawling settlement known as Peace Island. Now, what Peace Island is a very large mangrove swamp that's sort of on the, again, it's within the city, but it's kind of toward the edges of the city. For years, it was just uninhabited space. I mean, it's malarial, it's unsolid in every sense of the term. And for years, nobody's actually known who owned it. It was sort of, there have been rumors circulating around Monrovia that the various governments owned it, American corporation owned it, etc. But what happened when most of the squatters who were evicted from the Ministry of Defense, what they did was they left the building, and the Peace Island swamp is right in the shadow of the Ministry of Defense building. So what these young men did for the most part is they left the Ministry of Defense and they walked a couple hundred yards into the swamp and began to build a new settlement there. And again, this sort of, for the most part, this is a process that had been completed by 2010. By all accounts, Peace Island was until recently a barren spit of land at the edge of Monrovia, inaccessible by foot or car during the rainy season when the waters of the river and the swamp ran high. It was a forest, as one older resident of Peace Island, a former soldier, put it. There were monkeys, a lot of monkeys. The place was wild. It was a swamp. That language of monkeys was fascinating. I mean, when you talk to people about what Peace Island was, they're like, "Oh, it was just monkeys. Nothing but monkeys." But as soon as these guys began to move in, what they did was they created essentially a small town, and it's one that grew very quickly and it actually continues to grow. I've only seen one estimate of how many people actually live in the swamp right now, but it was 30,000 people, right? And there's reason to think that this is grossly overestimated. Nevertheless, it's now quite a large settlement. Everyone on Peace Island knows that they will soon be evicted again. Despite the uncertainties around its ownership, despite the confusion over what is to be done with it, everyone on the island seems to know that they're only there temporarily. However, even given the palpable sense that they are only in transit on Peace Island, almost as soon as they arrived there, these ex-combatants began to build houses with the most durable material they could afford. Unlike the stereotype of informal urban settlements, Peace Island's inhabitants are not building tightly packed makeshift compounds out of easily accessible materials. On Peace Island, houses are freestanding, single structures surrounded by bare earth, often which is just reclaimed from the swamp. Though they build them as quickly as possible, they do so with the most solid materials they can afford, even if this means that their houses are uninhabitable for long periods while the necessary materials are collected. None of this would seem to make any sense, given the precarious and temporary claim that Peace Island's residents actually have to the island. Why is there such a mad rush to build permanent housing on a temporary landscape? Why invest so much of one's capital, not to mention sweat equity, which is a different term, in a house that will soon be torn down? Why maintain an already ruined but as yet unbuilt structure? The story that Peace Island's inhabitants tell is that when the time comes for them to move out, the government will have no choice but to compensate them for, quote-unquote, their land and the structures they have put on it. There are too many trained military personnel on Peace Island for the government to evict them by force. So agents of the government will be deployed when the time comes to value the structures on the island and compensate its inhabitants accordingly. I have hope, said one young ex-soldier, and these are his terms. I'm a citizen of this country. I have a free mind. This is a decent area. So we pray that the government will not try to evict us by force. Government will feel for us because we are citizens. If any NGO or government says we must go, then maybe they'll see the value of my house and they'll help us to go. If they see the house and it's a fine, fine house, and they satisfy me, then I will go. I'm a citizen of the country. Now, the compensation for one's labors, he says, will be entirely dependent on one's physical presence on the urban landscape and the work one has done to fix that space through material built form. The rights that stem from being a, quote, citizen of the country are inextricably bound to being temporarily fixed in space and visible through a fine, fine house that one has managed to establish on otherwise unclaimed or ambiguous territory. He thinks he can put down a foundation and the government will compensate him because he's a citizen, was how one ex-combatant described the thinking of the average Peace Island resident. The larger and more solid one's footprint, the greater one's claim to citizenship, understood here again as the right to compensation for one's work. Now, in this regard, Peace Island's former life as an uninhabited swampland of uncertain destiny is an important part of its mythology. A dark forest filled with monkeys is, as another resident put it, neutral ground. It doesn't belong to anyone. Until, of course, someone claims it and makes that claim visible in a tangible, material way. This is the logic that Simon Njami has argued lies at the heart of African urbanism. The truly African part of the urban fabric is, in his terms, no man's land where the space seems to belong to the person occupying it and to him alone. Now, it's important to note that squatter's rights are in no way guaranteed in Liberian law. Liberian law, and this is actually a jumbled mess, and there's actually very little precedent for squatters being compensated if they are forced to move. It was required for a while by the World Bank if there were development projects that you had to compensate squatters if you pushed them out, but it's actually not, it didn't happen that often. And there were very few easily confirmable stories of this taking place. And yet it had become a crucial part of ex-combatants' stories of themselves and what they were doing, that you were going to be compensated if you were, if you got in the way and you had to be moved. This points to a second important ambiguity expressed by the fighter I quoted earlier. If any NGO or government says we must go, they'll help us to go. The state to which he as a citizen can appeal for his rights is impossible to locate. It may be a government agency, though it could as easily be a foreign government like the United States, it could be the United Nations, an NGO, or the World Bank. The point is that he, like thousands of others, sees himself surrounded by a diverse landscape of authorizing institutions. Any one of these may make a claim on the space that he occupies, and so his labor is to make himself as materially fixed and visible in that location as he possibly can. And we saw this logic being repeated all over Monrovia over the last couple of years. Essentially, ex-combatants have begun to see the profitability of being forced to move. Another one of the buildings that I'm writing about in this book is the Liberia Broadcasting Service. And you have, for years, you have had families of ex-combatants living in this space. And even now, there's about 80 of them that continue to squat in the building. And I was interviewing Martin, who is the chairman of the residents association here, and he said nobody expects to be allowed to remain here. We won't. We don't want to stay here, even though we've been here for 10 years and we've created this this community within it. But nobody's going to walk out without compensation. He said, "We'll not just gather our things and walk out." He told me, "We're asking the owners of this building to compensate us." So like the ex-combatants of Peace Island, the residents of LBS understand that profitability lies in the way one configures fixity and movement vis-a-vis the built forms of the city. As with the residents of Peace Island, however, it's not at all clear who it is that might actually assess their homes or fund their relocation. Through the labors of their bodies, they make an appeal to an anonymous or at least unlocatable authority. They deploy the language of rights and citizenship, but the rights to which they are laying claim by the way they occupy the city is ultimately the right to payment for their labor. In this case, the labor of existing in space in a fixed and mobile way. They still by and large occupy the city in enclaves that they know will soon be shifted to new locations, and violence remains the animating principle that holds those spaces together. But at this moment, there's a countervailing and contradictory imperative to use the labors of the body to become entrenched and visibly fixed in the city. So, in conclusion, where does this leave us? Now, in Monrovia today, I think we find a city that looks very much like those described elsewhere on the continent by writers like Simone de Beaujami, a liquid, immaterial city. It's a heterotopic space of invention. It's a form of African urbanism, moreover, that would seem to reflect all of the potential that Chatterjee and other observers see in interstitial urban spaces for the creation of a political society. Elsewhere, we've seen a global landscape of urban political movements that are doing just that, a wave of what David Harvey has called a spirit of protest and revolt that spread contagiously through urban networks. And this is a landscape of which Monrovians are very well aware. People in Monrovia, no less than anybody else in the world, are very much aware of the kinds of popular protests that have been happening around the globe in various urban spaces. What's more, in Monrovia, we find a long history of violence and a continued discourse of violent mobilization. Liberia's ex-combatants resort continuously to the language of renewed warfare and a new revolution if their situation does not improve. What we don't have, however, is a kind of political imaginary that allows this to congeal into political society. For all its inventiveness, Monrovia's ex-combatants have yet to invent a new politics of space. They continue to make no effort to stake a claim on the spaces they occupy outside of the claim that it has a market value. They have not yet invented a politics of the governed that would lead them to protest when they are evicted from buildings like the Ministry of Defense, urban spaces in which they have lived for more than a decade, and after which they are forced to dwell in even more inhospitable and untenable gaps in the city. Indeed, they seem to come to such evictions as not only see such evictions as not only inevitable, but perversely desirable, because they may be profitable, although that is not guaranteed. The upshot isn't so much that for Monrovia's ex-combatants, the city exists beyond its architecture. It seems more the case here that we have a populace that cannot imagine the city's architecture to have different meanings. For all the insecurity and uncertainty they face, Monrovia's ex-combatants have not yet learned to live dangerously. So I will end with that. Thank you for staying awake.